Our in-depth guest today is Laurie Tobias, author of the new memoir, Storm Beat, A Journalist Reports from the Oregon Coast, published by Oregon State University Press. Laurie has worked in journalism for over 25 years, including time at the Rocky Mountain News as a columnist and features writer, and as a staff writer for The Oregonian. Her novel, Wander, won the 2017 Nancy Pearl Book Award in Literary Fiction and was a finalist in the Best New Fiction category of the 2017 International Book Awards. Stormbeat is Laurie's first book of nonfiction and chronicles her years covering the Oregon coast from 2004 to 2013. In the words of writer Lynn Schooler, Stormbeat takes the reader on a rapid-fire journey into the dark underbelly of the beautiful, fog-wreathed coast of Oregon, where horrors, heroes, and disasters form the mosaic of a reporter's life. It's a page-turner and a great read. Laurie, thanks for joining us today from your home on the Oregon coast.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, Laurie, as mentioned in the intro, you were a writer for the Rocky Mountain News, one of the biggest and oldest daily newspapers. When I looked it up, amazing, going back to 1859 in the U.S. Sadly, it closed down about 10 years ago, but you left before that in the year 2000. How'd you go from Denver to the Oregon coast?
Well, I'll try to give you the thumbnail sketch.
Yes.
I grew up in Pennsylvania, and when I graduated high school, my sister was in Alaska with the Air Force, and she asked me to come up to Anchorage and help with her toddler. So she actually was, I think, more of an infant, but so she could go on maneuvers in Hawaii. And of course I said, no, I'm not going to Alaska, but I ended up in Alaska. And once I got up there, I realized that there was this whole big world out there, because prior I had been no further than the Jersey Shore. So I enrolled in the university, met my husband, who was an apprentice lineman. And when you're a lineman in the construction trade, it's called tramping. You're a tramp lineman. So once you become a journeyman, you can pretty much go anywhere there's work. So I told you I'd do the short. So anyway, my husband and I started following the work. That's what they do. And so we went from Alaska to Pennsylvania, which is where the apprenticeship school sent him because of the recession and there was no work in Alaska. And then from there to Connecticut, and from there to Seattle, and from there to Southern Oregon, where we didn't have much money. We were kids, so we camped all the time, and we camped on the coast. And I said to my husband, if we ever settle down, this is where I'm going to settle down. And I meant specifically Newport. And then we ended up in Denver and skied for a few years, and I signed on for Rocky, and I had a column, and I was a features writer, and I loved the Rocky, but I had this wanderlust, and because we could go, then I saw there was an opening here in Newport, and kind of on a lark, it was right after the first year anniversary of Columbine. The Post and the Rocky had just signed a JOA, joint operating agreement. I don't even think they do them anymore, but so one paper gets a Sunday, one paper gets a Saturday, both papers get 5 days a week, but whichever paper gets the Sunday is considered the winner. It was just very, very heavy time. And there was this opening at a utility on the Oregon coast. And my husband sent his resume. And literally by week's end, he was interviewing. And we were on our way to come out here for a live interview. They offered him the job at lunch while we were sitting in a hotel in Agate Beach. And that is how I got to the Oregon coast.
Now, the chapters in Stormbeat are in chronological order from when you started writing for The Oregonian, and you were living in Newport, of course, in 2004 to when you left in 2013. And when you first moved to Newport, you wrote mostly magazine features and travel stories, many of those having nothing to do with the coast. You talked about going all over the place and having great parties and staying in wonderful hotel rooms and eating feasts. Now, how'd you connect with The Oregonian after that and start covering local stories for them?
Well, the truth is, when I got here to the Oregon coast, I was freelancing for The Oregonian within, I'd say, 6 months. I was writing for Joni Carlin's home section. I wrote for Sue Hobart's travel section. So it was all just this big muddle of whoever I could write for, I would. Travel writing was a big deal back then, and there were all kinds of venues for it, which I can't say there are now. So people knew that I would do travel stories on the Oregon coast because I was still seeing with fresh eyes, which is what I find when you go someplace new. You see it in a way a local doesn't. And I still had that when I first moved here. Everything was new to me, the bayfront, the oyster farm, you know, the various neighborhoods, Nye Beach. It was all, so I could write it as a travel writer then, and I did. And that helped me establish my reputation with the Oregonian. But meanwhile, I was writing to Peter Badia and saying, you know, I think you need a you need a columnist over here. Of course, they didn't bite, but that's how it all the conversation started. And literally one day after I hadn't heard from Peter for maybe 3 years, I wrote and I said, you know, da 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 da. And he wrote me back. It was a Sunday, and he said, you know, I was just reading your story in Portland Monthly and wondering if you'd want to write for us.
You write of, not from Peter, I don't think, but you got some very good advice early in your Oregonian career from your editor at the time. You kind of pitched a story, and you just asked him, is that a story? Now, there's something that he wants in the newspaper that you should cover. He answered, Laurie, if someone dies, that's a story. And it turned out there was no shortage of those types of stories on your beat. Many of us here in Oregon think of the coast as a place of great peace and beauty, a refuge of sorts. But you've said, and I quote, it's also quite dangerous. If you're not watching yourself and do stupid things, you can pay very dearly. That was some hard-earned wisdom for you, I think.
It was. It's been a learning experience for myself, because you come here and you do see the beauty, the rugged beauty. I don't think there's any place else, certainly not in this country, like this place. I'm still not over it. 20 years, and I still look out and I'm awed, and I'm so grateful to be able to live here. But you learn a piece at a time, and until you kind of internalize it. And I say that because I remember I used to run on the beach when I got here, and I used to see these warnings about stay away from logs. And I understood it, but you kind of understand it in a very intellectual manner, as opposed to like real danger. I'm running on the beach, and there are these two girls, probably 13, 14, and they're riding a log in the surf. And I'm screaming at them, and they can't hear me because of the surf. And so you see these little things, you cover these stories that are not little, but they're tragic. And it adds up to where, unfortunately, it's made me very wary. But I've always been a little like that anyway. So, but yeah, you don't turn your back on the ocean, and you know, when the crab fleet goes out, you worry about the crab fleet, and you just start, I'm always aware of it, but I think that's just natural because of so many years of tragedy.
Now, those stories in the book, and there's quite a few, tragedies, as you mentioned, people swept out to sea by sneaker waves, falling from cliffs in the Coast Range, maybe those two girls riding the log, fishing boats going out and drowning in storms because the tide there gets pretty rough, the ocean. And surprisingly, for me at least, there were even a few murder-suicides. There's one in particular that was not only tragic, but somewhat of a mystery, and that's the story of a couple, Astrid Schlaps and Richard Hunter. They were found dead by gunshot in their Manzanita home, and the local police and sheriff's office, and you had good contacts with both of those, were calling it a suicide pact, and they were ready to close the case, but you and other residents had doubts. I wonder if you could tell a little about that story. That was one of the more fascinating ones for me in the book.
You know, that story actually took a really personal toll, and I can't exactly tell you why, but I have some inkling. I found out about it, I think it must have been a Sunday, from a gentleman who I've become good friends with, and he's an old news hound, and he would tip me off to stories that I should be aware of, because the coast is a big place. And he wrote me and said, there's two bodies in a house and such a street. And, you know, he told me whose house it belonged to, so we had an inkling that the bodies had been there for some time. So I just waited to talk to the police. And I think my colleagues did a story, you know, the kind of thing you do at a newspaper, just say, yeah, we're on this, but it was a Sunday. And so I ended up going into it, you know, we knew who the people were. And it's amazing the rumors that fly right away. And as a reporter, you don't really understand, or you understand, but you don't know that how unfounded it is. Why would somebody just say something like that? So the first thing that people said is that she was terminal with cancer. So then you have the suicide pact, right, except for that she wasn't terminal with cancer. And there actually was no pact. And it went on for weeks and weeks. And I was willing to just say, hey, it's a murder-suicide. But all of their friends just would not accept that. They loved this couple, and they just would not accept it. And finally, you know, they came to me and said, if you don't talk to the police, this is going to go down as a botched murder investigation. You need to tell them to keep investigating. Meanwhile, a young woman up there wrote me a note with the clipping from a news story of a woman who was going to prison for threatening to kill her partner and then kill herself. And she actually did time for it. And she was a friend of the deceased. So all of a sudden there was like, wait a minute, this is a little coincidental. So I called Todd Anderson. And I just want to say very quickly, Todd Anderson was one of the best sources I could have ever had. We were very close to the point. I would just call.
He was
Todd,
the,
it's me.
He was the sheriff, right, Laurie?
Yeah. So when I called him and said, hey, he went and he's like, he listened to me. He went to the local cops because they were all working together, OSP, Tillamook County Sheriff's, the Manzanita Police. And they took me seriously and they just furthered their research. And just not that they wouldn't have, but they were willing to say, okay, we're going to do what it takes until the people in Tillamook County understand that this really was a murder-suicide. And in the end, they got the phone records. And I don't know why. I'm not trying to cast aspersions. All I know is that Richard was deeply in debt. And the house in Portland was in foreclosure. That was a known fact. Nobody seemed to be bothered. But the house in Manzanita, which was Astrid's dream, was also in foreclosure. And she didn't know any of this, as far as we know. So I think it got so personal for me because people called me day and night and day and night, and you have to do something. And they wrote me. And this went on for a long time. I think I did probably four stories on the twist, just kind of unheard of. We don't even report on suicides. But it had turned out that they bought a gun so that when she was in Manzanita alone, she felt safe, which is an irony in itself because Manzanita, if somebody gets busted, it's probably for blown off fireworks. And the weirdest part, and you may have read this, is a year later, I never knew where their house was. I'm in Manzanita for a vacation with my husband, and I see an estate sale, and I say, hey, let's stop. And it turned out to be their estate sale. And it was one of the most uncanny experiences I have ever had in my life.
There's just so many great stories in the book. That's one that just stood out for me. I want to get to also that you mentioned throughout the book your anxiety over financial problems at the Oregonian, the constant threat of layoffs, which eventually happened to you in June 2013. And of course, we already talked about your first paper, the Rocky Mount News, which went under in 2009 after being in operation since 1859. With the decline of print journalism, what do you think we're losing?
Oh, everything. I can't even begin to. In the beginning, I was saddened to lose the print edition. And I don't know if you'll recall, but the Oregonian was slow to go to the web. We didn't jump on it near as fast as everyone else did. And then when we did, I was sort of like, no, don't post that. You're going to lose the freshness of this, the Monday morning, Tuesday morning, the morning paper. I want my story to be enjoyed in the morning. I don't want just this brief thing flittering by on the web. And then after a while, you kind of go, okay, this is the new reality. But I can understand that the newspaper is being replaced digitally. And I think that's just the way it has to be. But I'm afraid that the newspaper as a digital format is not going to last either. And the newspaper journalism as the gatekeeper, as the guard, as the, the word I'm looking
The
for here.
guardian of democracy, in a way.
Yes, once that's gone, I just don't understand what we're going to have. And what I'm seeing with people, the way journalists are being treated, just astonishes me.
I was just reading today in the Sunday New York Times article of they interviewed several journalists who were at the insurrection attempt last week. It's just frightening what they were up against.
Therese Bottomley did a good editorial on that too, a couple days ago from the Oregonian.
And as you mentioned, what we're losing, maybe that's a big reason why we're in the mess we're in right now in the country, among a few other reasons, I guess.
Well, the distrust of the media just is mind-boggling. And I can remember both when the Rocky closed and when the Oregonian had layoffs, the comments from people and the name-calling. It's just, there's no sense that these are human beings losing their livelihood. There's just this name-calling and what horrible people journalists are. And I don't know where that grows from. I really don't.
Now, something a little lighter than kind of the decline of journalism in the United States democracy. You have a live stream reading coming up tomorrow. That's Thursday, January 14th, at Portland's Annie Bloom's Books, and you'll be joined by Laura Stanfeld, who we've interviewed before on KBOO several times. She's the publisher at Forest Avenue Press, author of the recent zine Sad House: Parenting, Grief, and Creativity in the Coronavirus Crisis. Now, Laura told me that you both covered the Oregon coast at one time together. Well, actually, for competing newspapers. So the reading should be a nice reunion for you both. Are you looking forward to that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Laura and I's paths have crossed back and forth over the years. And I think when we were both reporters, or, and I was with the Oregonian daily running hard and fast, and I think I didn't reach out as much as I should have to other reporters, but that's kind of the nature of the business in a daily, with it being the size of the Oregonian, you're running so hard and so fast. But we connected and reconnected and we're good friends. And I love Laura, for she is the most supportive person of writers in this state. And her zine, by the way, is really, I just started reading it today and it's lovely. There's a discourse with her children where they decide, they're talking about words and they come up with how the word container can speak to our homes now, because we are contained in this house. And I thought, oh, wow, out of the mouth of babes, you know, that's something a kid would think of. That I said, Laura, I think container needs to be a code word for us.
We've been talking with Laurie Tobias, author of the new memoir, Stormbeat, A Journalist Reports from the Oregon Coast, from Oregon State University Press. Laurie will be doing a live stream event at Portland's Annie Bloom's bookstore tomorrow, Thursday, January 14th at 7 p.m. She'll be joined in conversation with Laura Stanfill, publisher at Forest Avenue Press and author of the recent zine Sad House, Parenting, Grief, and Creativity in the Coronavirus Crisis. You can find out more and register for the event online at anniblooms.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOOS News In Depth.